It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our Curious Wisconsin segment takes us back to Civil War era Wisconsin to a colony of freed slaves.
First, newly elected Menominee Chairwoman Lori Boveen delivered the State of the Tribes address today at the state capitol. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called it one of the biggest speeches in recent history for her people.
Her tribe, the Menominee, are awaiting a decision on their Kenosha Casino proposal, a proposal that's contested by other tribes in Wisconsin. Issues that unite the tribes include preventing mines in northern Wisconsin and a movement to rename Native American-themed school mascots.
Last year, the Lakota Ray chairman harshly criticized the state legislature, and the Assembly Speaker Pro Tem at the time, Bill Kramer, walked out. Former Menominee Chairman Craig Korn announced earlier this month that the speech today would strike a more conciliatory tone. WPR State Government reporter Sean Johnson joins us now to talk about the State of the Tribes address. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sean, so the big issue that I imagine was hanging over the speech today for the Menominee Nation was their Kenosha Casino proposal. Did it come up?
It did not. I mean, it was sort of alluded to, but not in the way that you might have expected with the Menominee giving the address. Actually, just looking back, back in mid-January, I had a chance to talk to then-Chairman Korn, and, you know, it had just been decided that the Menominee were going to give this address. And at that time, Chairman Korn was saying, yeah, we're going to talk about the casino proposal. That's huge for us. But, you know, over the course of the editing process, you know, that got dropped. This is a speech that represents all the state's tribes. And, you know, Craig Korn, who was hoping to be the chairman to give this speech today, wasn't there. It was Chairwoman Lori Boveen.
And she was elected, I understand it, on Sunday.
Right. And it's a regularly scheduled election. So it's not like, you know, there was any kind of surprise uprising or change. But you did have this change of leadership very close to the speech. Still, though, she definitely had a lengthy speech, hit on many issues near and dear to her heart, to the tribe's heart.
Now, she was delivering this speech feet away from leaders of the Potawatomi and the Ho-Chunk tribes who contest the casino. Was there tension there?
You know, if there was, you didn't see it, and it could be because it was, you know, it was a fairly politically deaf speech. She didn't get into an issue that divides them, and really at a time when her tribe is asking the governor for approval of this tribe, you know, she didn't have a speech that was filled with attacks on him or any of his policies, really. The notable exception would be on the mascot bill, which she did touch on, but, you know, for something like the mining bill, which was a huge issue in last year's State of the Tribes address, where, you know, tribes have been very critical of the legislature and the governor, steered clear of mentioning that mine specifically.
So in terms of issues that unite the tribes, tell us about some of the areas she touched on.
Well, on the mascot bill, that is one where you don't see, you know, any splintering among tribal leaders. They all believe that the change that the legislature made this year that would make it, you know, would make it hard to remove a school mascot that's a Native American mascot was a bad idea. And so, you know, that they she felt definitely at liberty to speak on that on behalf of all the tribes. And she said, you know, that their children, that Native American children, should not be subjected to inaccurate representations of their culture. And you had, at that moment, half the assembly stood and applauded, Democrats who voted against the change this year, and Republicans largely stayed in their seats.
And there was supposed to be a more conciliatory tone, at least that was what had been sort of previewed when we thought that Chairman Craig Korn would be doing the speech. Was there a conciliatory tone?
Yeah, I mean, I think there still was. I mean, as far as a news lead, it's going to be that the comments about the mascot bill. But if you look at the rest of the speech, by and large, she thanked the legislature repeatedly for, you know, smaller bills that the tribes did support. She multiple times talked about being a partner with the legislature on issues that affect them both, and, you know, talked about trying to forge compromises and find common ground where they can. So, you know, from a news perspective, there's going to be a lot of focus on what she said about the mascots. But if you were sitting there listening to the speech, you know, this was definitely a speech that struck that conciliatory tone.
And Sean, I'm going to jump in. We're experiencing some technical difficulties hearing you. Can we move to the phone quickly and easily?
All right, I'm right. You can get me.
All right, and there you are.
All right, excellent.
Okay, I think that's going to be better for everyone.
Okay.
As you were talking about the tone there, and I wonder if, given the tension surrounding the proposed Menominee Casino, was this speech at all a departure from speeches of years past?
You know, in the last couple speeches in recent memory, there has been a lot of tension because you had this issue. The potential iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin was just this outstanding issue that was either being dealt with or was about to be dealt with. And, you know, for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, one of the state's 11 federally recognized Native American tribes, you know, that was a huge issue and one that they continue to fight as hard as they can. And, yeah, so you had a very contentious nature there. And that just doesn't exist. That didn't exist in this speech. It's not that some of the same issues aren't out there. You didn't see them come up in the same way. And, you know, as I mentioned, she didn't even mention the mining bill specifically. And as far as the Kenosha Casino, you know, maybe not every legislator's on the same page there, but you do have Republican leadership in the Assembly very strongly behind her tribe's, you know, proposal to get that casino. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is in favor. A number of lawmakers are in favor. And, you know, even if they weren't, that's not in their court right now. It's in the governor's hands to make that decision.
Now, as I understand it, the person who gives this address rotates each year, and that this year it happened to be the Menominee tribe's turn. But do you have a sense of how much cooperation there is and communication among the tribes, especially in the lead up to an address like this?
I think they were down to just a couple tribes who hadn't given it. And so in talking to the Great Lakes Intertribal Council a few weeks back, seeing that the Menominee was going to give this speech, you know, immediately you think, well, they're doing that because of the casino. But in talking to the Great Lakes Intertribal Council, at least what they told me, they didn't view it that way. It was just a matter of who's left and giving these speeches. It is something that the legislature's been doing, you know, back since 2005 now, every year in the state assembly. And so this was the Menominee's turn, and it came at a good time for them. But it's not something that they used to kind of hammer home the point of the casino bid.
So before we let you go, any sense of issues that may be taking more of a priority as we go forward into the year?
In terms of what she talked about there, the ones that really grab your attention, the mascot bill, it's not going to change in the legislature. I mean, they feel like they've addressed that. The governor signed it. In terms of mining, that's something, and environmental issues, you know, that's just a really broad issue. And it was in the way that she laid it out. And that's going to be an issue where you have continued tension between the tribes and the legislature.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate
it.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's state government reporter. He's talking about the State of the Tribes address delivered earlier today.
In today's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we visit a lost piece of Wisconsin history.
During the Civil War, a group of freed slaves found their way to Wisconsin and became part of a community in Dodge County.
Gregory Bond joins us now. He's a historian researching freed slaves in Civil War era Wisconsin. We've linked his recent New York Times piece on the Central Time Facebook page. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is the Fox Lake Negro Colony, it was called at the time. How did it get started?
It's an interesting question. It's a long history. It actually starts if you go back to the beginning of the Civil War, a very important decision was made by Union Army and political leaders to classify slaves who escaped to the Union Army lines as contraband of war, mm-hmm. and they would not therefore be returned to their owners who they escaped from. So this naturally encouraged lots of slaves in the South to try to escape when they had the chance. And the colony got started when several freed slaves from Alabama, Arkansas, and Kentucky made it to various Union Army camps and then were sort of taken care of by the Union Army. And they eventually ended up in Cairo, Illinois, at the very southern tip of Illinois, in a contraband camp.
And in the piece I just mentioned, the New York Times, you tell the story of Samuel Matthews and his family. Can you tell us how they came from slavery to Wisconsin?
Sure. They were in northwestern Alabama in Franklin County near Tuscumbia. And the army of Union General William Rosecrans was nearby. And the local population in Alabama talked of impressing Samuel Matthews into service in the Confederate Army as a cook. And he didn't want to fight for his master's army. So he and his wife, Sarah, and his two children, Richard Matthews and Ellen Matthews, they escaped and ran away from their plantation and made it to Tuscumbia, which was being occupied by Union Army troops. And then they sort of followed the Union Army into Mississippi and eventually to Helena, Arkansas, where there's a contraband camp, and then eventually to Cairo, Illinois, which was the main contraband camp in that part of the country.
And then that next step from Cairo, Illinois, up to Dodge County.
Yes. At the same time, this is all happening in the South. In Dodge County, a farmer's in Trenton, Wisconsin, which is in sort of northeastern Dodge County between Fond du Lac and Fox Lake. The farmers were running into manpower shortage. They didn't have enough people to help them till the land.
Because so, presumably some people were away
exactly,
at the front.
Exactly. A lot of soldiers from Dodge County were in the Army. So it was a very Republican area, staunchly Republican, supportive of the war. And they get this idea of they knew that there are all these freed slaves in the South who had escaped from their homes and were in these camps with nearly nowhere to go. So they organized a group of farmers who were willing to host these freedmen. And they sent Edison P. Cady, who was an elder in the Baptist Church in Trenton, went down to Cairo and found about 39 African-Americans freed slaves who were willing to come to Dodge County and work in these farms.
Including Samuel Matthews,
including
who
we were the Matthews
talking
family.
About. How did Wisconsin's white residents react to the arrival of this community of freed slaves?
That's a good question. They were split, as you can imagine. The Civil War, especially this happened in 1863. The freed slaves arrived in Trenton in March or April 1863. The war was 3 years old at that point. Sort of a stalemate in certain places, and the white population was split. Some people in Dodge County were very supportive of the war, the farmers who brought the freed slaves up, but other people in Dodge County, especially it seems like in Beaver Dam, were what they called copperheads, Democrats who opposed the war. And it was very controversial when the freed slaves were brought up. And the Beaver Dam Argus, one of the leading newspapers in Beaver Dam, was very critical of these freed slaves coming to Dodge County.
And do we know, are there records of what those freed slaves made of Wisconsin? It's a very different environment in terms of people, climate, everything, really.
Unfortunately, it's hard to get at records of the freed slaves talking for themselves. Most of the available resources are in white newspapers or people talking about white people in Fox Lake talking about the community in retrospect. They seemed to be happy. They were integrated into the local white church in Dodge County, the Baptist Church in Trenton. They were taken by their patrons to go to church. Many of them stayed in the area, which I find indicative of the reception they got and how they liked it. Through most of the 19th century, a lot of these immigrants actually stayed in Trenton and moved to Fox Lake eventually. So they seem to have liked the change.
Doing a research like this, I imagine there must be like a holy grail out there to like find a diary or didn't write an oral history transcription or something like that.
That would be the holy grail. One of the reasons that makes this project actually doable is there is a woman in Fox Lake who worked at the Fox Lake Public Library. She was the daughter of a local politician in Fox Lake in the early 20th century, Harriet O'Donnell. And she, in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, when most of the African Americans moved on, interviewed people in the area, including the few remaining African Americans, and wrote a bunch of stuff that was unpublished that was just sitting in the Fox Lake Public Library, her sort of summary of these interviews she did with both white people and black people who remembered the colony. So that really makes, and she was a good historian. Pretty much everything I can check out in the other sources, she was right on. So some of the stuff that she writes about that I can't verify through other sources seems to be reasonably accurate. But beyond that, I'm in the process of trying to track down some of the relatives of the people of the African Americans who came to Fox Lake, and I'd love to perhaps find some pictures, some letters, some stuff you're saying from the people who came to Fox Lake. I haven't contacted anyone yet, but I'm hoping something was saved through the years for these families.
About how many freed slaves ended up living in that community?
Sure. The original group was about 39. It varies between 35 and 40. The newspaper is talking about. And it was successful. They, like I said, most of them moved to Fox Lake. By as early as 1865, the Samuel Matthews and his family bought a house in October 1865, and other families moved to Fox Lake. And it grew. Other people, other African-Americans moved to Fox Lake. I think these were people who were who had known the immigrants when they're in the South. And they so more African-Americans came to Fox Lake. And by about 1880, the census records 66 people in Fox Lake, which is about 7% of the population, with about 10 other people in surrounding areas. So it seems to peak around 76 or 80 residents. And then, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, the community gets smaller as we go through the rest of the 19th century.
Yeah, let's talk about the Civil War ends, slavery ends in the South. What happened to the Fox Lake community then?
It thrives for a while. In the 1870s, they started a church, a congregation of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, which seemed to be the center of the community. The church had, they had Christmas tree celebrations, they had Thanksgiving dinners, 4th of July celebrations, they had ice cream socials, strawberry ice cream seemed very popular. And these festivals seemed to be attended by the African American community, but also by white people living in Fox Lake. And there are stories of white and black men of working age going to Chicago, going to lumber camps in Wisconsin, working together. So it seemed rather successful for a while. But by about the 1890s, two tensions sort of are operating on the community that tend to cause the community to disperse. First is the mechanization of farm labor. Most of these men worked on farms, and you have farm labor being mechanized, so you need fewer and fewer people to actually be out in the fields. And that means a lot of people lose their livelihoods. So they tend to go to bigger places, Beloit, Milwaukee, especially Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, for better economic opportunities. But at the same time, we usually consider, when we think about race relations in the United States, a straight line from slavery or segregation to integration. Things just sort of happen in a straight line. But it's not that simple. These things ebb and flow. Race relations are better sometimes, worse sometimes. And it seems throughout the country in the 1880s, 1890s, after Reconstruction, when the North sort of steps away from protecting the political rights and social rights of African Americans in the South, throughout the country, it becomes more problematic, interactions between the races. And this affects Fox Lake. And you have a series of incidents where especially black men are dating white women, and that causes some trouble in the community. But I think it's bigger than just – I think that's often one of the excuses used to sort of justify not liking relationships between blacks and whites. So it seems in a greater sense – things weren't going well between the white residents and black residents of Fox Lake, which also encourages people to leave for greener pastures.
So a community that welcomed these freed slaves during the Civil War, a generation later, is in some ways turning against
them. Yeah, it seems to be the case, unfortunately.
Was this, in your research, the only community like this in Wisconsin, or were there others in the state?
There were a few others. Actually, in Fond du Lac in 1862, another group of freed slaves from this contraband camp in Cairo came up to Fond du Lac in 1862. And there are also a few other rural areas, one in southwestern Wisconsin, which has gotten the most attention historically. But it's very few. It's rather unusual to have these communities of African Americans in Wisconsin at this time period.
And just briefly, one thing I forgot to ask, these people like Samuel Matthews ended up in Wisconsin. Did some of them go back and fight in the war before it ended?
Yes, actually. Hayden Netter, It comes to Fox Lake in 1863, and then 9 months later, he's drafted by the Union Army and fights in three different white regiments, which are mostly white regiments, which is rather unusual. You had a handful of African-American soldiers who actually fight with alongside white men instead of in the colored units, and there are a couple other people from the area who go and fight in the Union Army.
And Samuel Matthews lived in Wisconsin for a while after
the war.
He
did. He lived. He dies in 1896. His wife, Sarah Matthews, dies in 1914. And his family, actually the only family that stays in Fox Lake through the 20th century. And the Matthews' great-great-granddaughter just died a couple years ago before I got a chance to interview her. And she seemed to be the last direct descendant of the original immigrants in Fox Lake. There are a few other ancestors in Beaver Dam and other parts of Wisconsin across the country. I'm trying to track some of these descendants down.
Gregory, thanks for joining us and good luck.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's Gregory Bond. He's a historian talking about his research on the history of freed slaves here in Wisconsin.
Best-selling writer Gary Steingart has until now been best known for his novels Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story, which was named one of the 10 best books of the year by New York Times Book Review and Time Magazine.
In his novels, Steingart mined the raw material of his life as fodder for fiction. Now he's getting rave reviews for telling the truth in his new memoir, Little Failure. The book is the story of Steingart's immigrant experience moving with his family from Soviet Russia to Queens, New York in 1979.
And it's also the history of his strange and at times searing relationship with his parents and the forces that made him the writer he is today. Gary, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, I read a quote from you recently about your new memoir and about writing, and the gist of it was that for you, the act of writing is something that should make you bleed. And this memoir, it sort of has that feeling, like you bled a little for it. It just feels incredibly honest. What was your experience like writing a memoir after having written fiction?
Yeah, there's about 350 pages in this book, and each one was a real nice paper cut. And so there was a nice amount of Band-Aids used afterwards. It's tough. You know, I've written satires before, and they're fun to write. You have a rollicking good time, and you can get a little deep, but you can always sort of hide under humor. That's your sort of safety blanket. But with a memoir, which has to be the truth, a lot of stuff was very funny growing up in two different countries, the Soviet Union and the United States, but a lot of stuff was paper cut worthy, and that's, I think, what I went with.
Well, the title of your book is Little Failure. It's a Russian equivalent that your mother uses. It's a nickname from her. And at one point in the book, you know, you ask the reader to notice just how often the words anxious and mother appear together in your book. Can you talk about what that relationship was like?
Yeah, she was like many Soviet Jewish mothers, not all of them, but many. She had a terrific kind of anxiety that I think, was the result of being born in 1945, just as Hitler's armies were being vanquished and just as Stalin was, again, starting up with a new purge. So all around her, so many relatives. She has a whole photo album called Uncle So-and-So in Belarusia, whole family murdered and buried alive. You know, not many people have photo albums like that. So I think genetically and historically she was very predisposed to be quite anxious. But when I was growing up, and I was very sick as a child, that anxiety only increased. I was very asthmatic, and she kept, you know, locking me in the rooms so that the microbes wouldn't get me and stuff like that. And that made me an anxious young boy, and I was scared of everything. I was scared of the telephone, which used to freak me out, and ceiling fans were particularly an object of great consternation.
Well, in this book, there's darkness and there's a lot of humor. You talked about your mother having lost so many relatives, and there are pictures in the book. I remember one in particular. It looks like a family shot, and you indicate two people. I think it's two of your father's relatives, and then the caption is, "Everyone else was about to die very soon," and you don't even bother naming them. So there's this humor and this darkness side by side. Is there something unique to your family, or is that something uniquely Russian?
I think that's a kind of Russian humor, which is very much humor from the edge of the grave, because what happens to Russians by and by is that terrible things happen. Entire generations are wiped out. There's always one stupid ideology after another, whether it's the worst serfdom that ever existed in the world, followed by the worst socialist system, and now followed by a horrible kleptocracy, turbo-capitalist type system. So, you know, bad things happen to Russians, and the only way to deal with that is to constantly poke fun at it.
Well, you were only, I think, 7 years old when you made the move from Leningrad to the United States to Queens, New York. Can you describe what that transition felt like to you?
It was was terrible. I mean, at first it was wonderful when we landed. And I remember the Pan Am terminal, those of you who are older may remember it, it was called the Worldport. It was just torn down, but it looked just like a flying saucer. That was the first thing we saw when we landed at JFK Airport. And I thought, my God, it's science fiction. We didn't have anything like that in the Soviet Union. Everything looked very drab and sad. And then my first Chevrolet Corvette, which I thought was an airplane just with its wings folded down. That's how futuristic it looked. But the other bad thing, I mean, the bad thing about it was that this was 1980, you know, the era of Ronald Reagan's evil empire speech. So the kids in Hebrew school hated me so much because I was wearing this big Soviet fur hat that I was telling them I wasn't born in Leningrad. I was born in East Berlin. I was trying to tell Jewish kids I was a German.
Yeah.
And that was a positive thing, better than being a Russian. So. It was a very strange time.
Is that part of, you know, what you would call it? I mean, we lump so many things under the heading the immigrant experience, but is that part of it, do you think, at some point for a lot of immigrants, kind of denying the culture, the country that you came from, but also feeling like you're not quite set up to join the country that you're in?
Yeah, it was very, I mean, all those movies, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, everything was, you know, everywhere I looked, there was some sign that the country was angry at me. And I couldn't understand it at all. Like the majority of immigrants from communist countries, my family was incredibly Republican. And I was, you know, until college, really, I was quite Republican as well. And I thought, I'm as patriotic. And you know, at age 11, I was sent a card from the National Rifle Association. At age 11, I was an NRA member. What's more patriotic than that, I thought, and still people hated me because they associated me with being Russian. So I started writing these science fiction stories for my class in a way that I wanted the kids to see me as something different, maybe a storyteller as opposed to just an immigrant. And losing my accent, which took a long, long time, that was really instrumental. And getting rid of that big fur hat. That really helped.
Did you try to get rid of the accent or did it just fall away?
I tried so hard. I would stand in front of a mirror and practice saying words in English. We had an apartment which had an attic. I was very proud that we had an attic in this garden apartment, and I kept saying, "Come to my attic," you know. So I tried to scrub attic, make attic sound like attic instead of attic. That was one of the hardest words.
Well, the core of this book is your relationship with your parents and the baggage they themselves carried from Russia metaphorically. And your father in particular, he seemed like this unknowable ocean of feeling and frustration. And when you were little, he was your best friend. What happened when you got older and you moved to America?
Well, I think that there was a very different style of parenting that people who grew up in the Soviet Union, which is in itself a very difficult place to grow up. It involves, you know, being able to call your son a little failure. There are occasional smacks across the head for grades not earned or math problems not solved or cottage cheese not finished. So it's a very different parenting style, and it's a hard one, whereas America is a much softer country. And I think that that's sort of the difficulty that we had. We didn't just cross international borders. We sort of crossed interplanetary ones when we came from the Soviet Union, the country that obviously no longer even exists. So I think that baggage weighed pretty heavily on me. But as I was writing this book, a lot of the anger I felt toward my parents in my 20s and 30s when I was struggling to become a writer, and I always didn't always feel like they were supportive of me. They wanted me to be a lawyer like all other immigrant parents. But some of that anger turned into a kind of feeling of sadness and sorrow for them by the time I finished writing this memoir, in the sense that they did grow up in the worst circumstances imaginable, and they never had the kind of chance that I had. You know, it was a very anti-Semitic society. My father wanted to be an opera singer, and there was just no way that he could have done that under that system, even though he had a wonderful voice. So I understood his frustrations, and I understood why they had so much trouble believing that I could succeed in any kind of creative capacity. And it's a very sad story in that way, because it's about people who love each other but who should understand each other more, but the gap in how we grew up is just too great.
Well, we're talking right now with author Gary Steingart about his new memoir. It's called Little Failure. It's a story of his family's move from Leningrad to the United States.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-123 with your questions or maybe your experiences. Does Gary's story sound familiar? did you immigrate to the United States? What was your experience like? Did you encounter similar problems fitting in, as Gary was just talking about, with language or with the stress it put on your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We're picking up now on our conversation with Gary Steingart about his new memoir. It's called Little Failure, and it's the story of his move from Leningrad to Queens, New York when he was 7 years old and the bumpy ride that made him the writer he is now.
And the door is open for you, too. Does listening bring back memories of your immigrant experience? You can reach us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got Jesus joining us from Walworth. Hi, Jesus.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Doing well. How are you?
Good, good. A little cold.
What do you think? Does this sound at all familiar?
Well, it does. It does. The adjustment, even if you have a good cultural background, it's hard sometimes in the United States for different reasons. Rejection or new things that you're not quite open, ready to embrace them, or things that you don't understand. But one thing that is very important for us to remember, speaking in general about Russia and Russians and any background from the Russian people, is that Russians have never been really, the people of Russia have never been our enemies. We were made to believe that. Remember that the Imperial Russia, the real Russia, was ready to intervene in assisting us and giving us economical and warfare support. In regards to being an immigrant here, it's been hard to adjust. I also wanted to be an opera singer. I had to let it go, unfortunately, for sickness. But other things have been important in my life, like taking a new career or new studies. And at times I encounter the rejection of certain people that impede progress in those things. But all I had to do is just kind of readjust my mindset and walk away and take a new route for anything that I've been wanted to do.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing, Jesus. Lots of thoughts there about what it's like. Any comments, Gary, for Jesus?
Well, yes. I mean, I think America still is. Nobody treats immigrants as well as America treats immigrants. That's really the main strength of our country. When you look at, for example, literary fiction, you'll see writers like Junot Diaz from the Dominican Republic and Chang Rae Lee from Korea and, you know, and Dumpal Lahiri from India. And they are a major part of our culture, of our literary culture, for sure. In a way that doesn't really happen in other countries like Germany, for example, or Italy, where there are immigrants, writers, and other artists, but they are not as well integrated. So in the end, America integrates you almost too well, so that by the next generation, there's very little besides, you know, an unusual sounding last name. There really is very little of the old culture.
Well, these days, I mean, you talked earlier about trying to get rid of your Russian accent and how that was crucial to your assimilating. But you wear Russia on your sleeve more these days. I read about you going on a vodka drinking tour with a journalist. You talk Russian culture. Do you feel Russian enough now that you can wear it, you know, with more pride?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because when I was in Hebrew school and during the Reagan era, I was very sheepish about being from the Soviet Union. But by the time I got to Oberlin College, which, as you know, is a kind of very progressive liberal arts college in Ohio, everyone was trying to be something other than just American. Everyone was flaunting as much as they could. So I was all ready to, you know, get that fur hat out of dry cleaning and put it back on again, because it seemed like that was the way things are. And today, you know, you look at Americans and there's a huge industry in just trying to figure out one's genealogy. Nobody's sort of content with just the, you know, just being American anymore. People want to know where they came from. And for someone like me who actually was born somewhere else, that's become a real story to tell. You know, the four books that I've written in one way or another concern immigration. And that's a topic I think that is going to be even more important to America as this country tilts from the kind of Anglo-Saxon Protestant white majority that it's had for so long.
Let's go back to the phones again. We've got Steve on the line from Eagle. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Gary. I'm a great admirer of your satire in particular and look forward to your memoir. I think the point I actually was going to ask about has kind of been made, that there's been a resurgence in America of just being proud of one's ethnic identity. I grew up about 10 years before you. I'm just an American native, but in a time where things were quite homogenized, and it seems that people have more pride now. So I guess my only point that hasn't been made now is maybe you could work to develop your Russian accent back again.
Do you still have it, Gary? Is it in there?
I can probably do that. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I, again, as I was saying, I mean, this is our greatest asset. That's why it drives me crazy when politicians try to, you know, hamper the inflow of immigrants into this country. The greatest strength we have, I mean, you look at so many other societies, even China, which is doing so well, but its population is graying. There's not a lot of in-migration. And that's going to hurt the economy and the whole society down the line, whereas we keep rejuvenating ourselves by constantly asking people to come, by constantly allowing people to settle within our shores. So immigration, good.
Well, the spotlight has been on Russia again because of the games in Sochi. Now, in the lead-up, the coverage had not been that positive. You know, there's a lot of talk about terrorism and the Ring of Steel around the city and all of that. And there were some critiques that, you know, American coverage of the Olympics was jingoistic and that, hey, guys, the Cold War is over. Did you notice? I don't know. Do you think any of that is true? What do you think, I guess, of the coverage and the way that we've been talking and thinking about Russia?
Well, I'll be honest, this is my 41st year of my life of not caring about the Winter Olympics. I just don't care. I like the Summer Olympics a little more because there's some swimming and badminton, that nerdish sport that I enjoy so much. But I always sort of miss out on the Winter Olympics. But I will say this, $50 billion, which is the price tag for this, which by far dwarfs anything else that's ever been spent. $8 billion, for example, was spent on the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. That is insane for a country that is still relatively impoverished. I mean, $50 billion could have rejuvenated huge parts of Russia, which outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, the two sort of Western cities, are in deep trouble. You know, you walk a little bit outside of Sochi and you see villages that may have existed in the 18th century in Russia. It's really a complete waste of money just to shore up one's image as a, you know, as a resurgent superpower. But, you know, that's since the time of the Potemkin village, that's how it's been done. Money has been spent on looking good instead of actually helping Russians live longer lives. I mean, the life expectancy for men is under 60 years old. Mm. So, yeah, if I was in Russia, I wouldn't just be middle-aged. I'd be, you know, closer to retirement at age 41. Mm. So it's just, I think, a misuse of money.
There's a thread in your book that we haven't gotten to yet, and that is your anxiety. When you got to America, when you were in your 20s, you started to have panic attacks. And I wonder if, in a way, this book is an attempt to get to the bottom of that, about where it came from and how it had to do with who you are, who your family is. Was there a therapeutic element here?
Well, as somebody who's been in psychotherapy for a very long time, that's really the therapy. The writing is... Maybe it's sort of, you know, it runs parallel to the therapy because it's something that you explore about yourself. So before you write a memoir, so much of it has already been said in a therapist's office. But the actual writing isn't that therapeutic. As we, you know, we started out with the image of paper cuts. That's pretty much correct. You know, I'd wake up every morning and I'd say, all right, I'm 12 years old now. What's going on? My parents are fighting. They're worried about losing their jobs. The kids hate me because, they, you know, I'm this big furry immigrant. And reliving those things was maybe helpful in terms of figuring out who I am, but certainly not helpful in terms of short-term mental health. You know, don't try this at home.
Gary, in the last 30 seconds we have, what do your parents think of this book? I gather they haven't quite read it yet because it hasn't been translated, but
right.
Based on what they know, what do they think?
I don't know. I mean, I really want to reserve their judgment for when they read it in Russian. Hopefully it'll be translated like my other books. And then, you know, then they can yell at me with some good foundation for it, for their anger.
All right. Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Take care.
That was Gary Steingart, the author of several novels, including Super Sad True Love Story. And the new memoir we've been talking about is called Little Failure.